Purposes BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0, Germany's Economics Podcast with Daniel Stelter.
Hello and a warm welcome to my podcast. My name is Daniel Stelter and I produce a weekly show in Germany called Beyond the Obvious. From time to time, I have the pleasure and honor to have English-speaking guests, and if this is the case, I produce this special edition of the podcast with the original interview. So, enjoy the show.
BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0. Tim Congdon is an economist and businessman who has for over 40 years argued in the UK policy debate that banking and money can have powerful influences on macroeconomic outcomes. He is currently chairman of the Institute of International Monetary Research, which he founded in 2014. The institute is based at the University of Buckingham, where he is a professor of economics. His most influential position was a member of the Treasury panel of independent forecasters, the so-called wise persons, between 1992 and 1997, which advised the Chancellor of the Exchequer on economic policy in a successful period for the UK economy.
Dear Tim, welcome back on my show. It's great to have you again.
It's very kind of you to ask me again. Thank you.
Tim, we spoke nearly a year ago in June of 2021, and you were quite right, actually, looking back, in predicting the return of inflation at a time when most economists in the US, but also in Germany, in the UK, were saying we don't see an uptick in inflation. Where do we stand now? What's your view now going forward? Is the worst in inflation behind us, or is inflation going to stay for a longer time?
I think the inflation's got a few months to run yet, possibly even will go on into 2023. I honestly don't know whether, talking about the United States, whether the peak in inflation is this year or next year, but there will probably be a high figure in September reported in October, and that may be the peak, or soon will be back down towards the kind of money numbers we had in the 2010s when inflation was very low. Now, having said all that, there is another condition to get inflation down, and that, I'm afraid, is that we need to be operating in all our economies with rather more unemployment than at present and rather more spare capacity generally than at present. So I'm sorry that what this money slowdown signals in the next 3, 4, 5 quarters is a recession. The severity of this recession will vary. It will probably be worse the United States, which had the worst money overshoot in 2020. It'll be pretty bad in the Eurozone and the UK. It'll be mild in Japan. There won't be a recession in China and most of Asia. Now, nowadays, China is a bigger importer than the USA, bigger importer certainly of commodities than the USA. So the world economy in 2023 will probably carry on growing, but at a very low rate, like 0.5% a year.
Then it's wrong what the central banks are doing now. They've been wrong in 2020 in being too generous together with the governments in generating
new
money.
Yeah.
And now, listening to you, you would say basically they are on the brakes too hard, and being on the brakes too hard is going to basically raise the cost of capital in a downturn.
Let me just first of all say money is dominated by bank deposits. We make most of our payments by transactions against bank deposits. Bank deposits exist. They exist whether central banks and governments are targeting them and looking at them or not. And the money supply will therefore grow because of the behavior of banks, commercial banks, that is, grow or contract, whatever. Now, I personally want governments and central banks to have a policy towards the growth of the quantity of money. They haven't had that for some years. It didn't matter too much in the 2010s when money growth was low and stable. In 2020, central banks in particular blundered in a stupid way. It's clear that COVID has damaged the supply side capacity of economies. They wanted to keep inflation down. They should have reduced money growth. Instead, they indulged in these fantastically over exaggerated and overdone. Asset purchases and money growth in the USA moved up at the peak to 26%, the highest since the Second World War. In a Eurozone, it went into double digits. In the UK, it reached 15%, it's the annual figures. In Japan, it peaked at about 8%. Now, the result of these central bank asset purchases was this explosion in money. It was evident actually by the middle of 2020. And by the middle of 2020, I had warned of inflation reaching 5-10%, probably going into double digits. That was the cause of the problem. Now, bank deposits exist. There is a rate of money growth. Do these organizations today have a policy towards the rate of money growth and so on? Not very clearly. What the Fed is saying is they'll reduce the size of their balance sheet. It's bank deposits that matter. Bank deposits held by you, me, companies, individuals, financial institutions. That's what matters. And they don't know what they're doing, frankly. We're returning to the kind of rates of money growth seen in the 2010s that will get us back to inflation of 2-3% over, say, 2 or 3 years, but in between, there's going to be, I'm afraid, a recession. These patterns have been repeated many times in the past.
But when you say monetary growth or money, basically what matters is private behavior. It's private money creation, private demand for money, private spending, and so on.
Yeah.
Therefore, on the other hand, you said you blame or you criticize the central banks for being too generous in the 21s.
They took decisions that increased our bank deposits, the bank deposits held by households, companies, and financial institutions. Yeah.
Which decision did they take? They kept on doing purchases
Very
of...
specific. The key thing was this... talk particularly about the United States, where in a way it's clearest. The Federal Reserve wanted in March 2020 to stabilize financial markets. So what it did was to, as remembering what they'd done in 2008-2009, sounds a bit odd, they borrow from the commercial banks by adding to commercial banks' cash reserves. They then have some funds by making this borrowing themselves. And they use these funds to purchase securities from, it's a technical phrase, non-bank private sector. Really, it means pension funds, insurance companies, holders of securities in general, including sometimes from households. This then means that the quantity of bank deposits held by the insurance companies, pension funds, households, etc., increases. This is the right way to deal with a recession. The growth of money then exploded in a few months. In a mere 4 months, the United States, the quantity of money rose by almost 20%, 19% to be precise. And that then led to this fantastic figure in the year to June 2020 of 26% growth in M3, basically total of all bank deposits, highest figure since the Second World War. Another element in the American picture, much more simple element if you wish, was that the government itself borrows from the central bank, as you or I can borrow from our bank. And then it used the funds to make what they called to make stimulus checks. This then went to hundreds of dollars each to the American households, went in the first instance into their bank deposits, that added to quantity of money. These sort of patterns were seen also in the Eurozone, where the ECB has been buying securities, in the UK also, and much less, by the way, in Japan. Monetary policy didn't change very much in spring of 2020.
So therefore, also the Japanese have lower inflation rates.
Yeah.
Okay, and now, basically, when the central banks reverse their purchases, or they just stop the purchases in the Eurozone and they start raising interest rates, what they basically try to influence indirectly is again our demand for credit and our therefore willingness to spend more money and create demand.
That's right. The banks can grow by acquiring claims on the central bank. That's this QE process I've been talking about, rather complicated. They can grow by lending more to the government, or they can grow by lending more to the private sector. Now, since 2008, sometimes some people say since 2010. Since 2008, the banks have been subject to the Basel III capital rules, and the growth of bank loan books has been much slower than in the previous, say, 30, 40, 50 years. That was the key reason why in the 2010s, the typical growth rate of banks' balance sheets was around about 3-4% a year, low growth of money, deposit liabilities of banks, and then low inflation. We're getting back to that now, that kind of pattern, because this overlay of these massive asset purchases that occurred in the COVID period are now coming to an end. And particularly in the US case, where I'm worried about a deep recession, the Federal Reserve plans to sell assets, sell some of the big stock of securities, about $9 trillion worth of securities, sell off from that stock of securities, as they say, to bring inflation down. It will have that effect.
If you now predict a severe recession in the US, isn't this going to lead to the exact opposite effect, that the central bank is going to start buying up assets at an even faster pace, and that they're going to lower interest rates, probably even...
Daniel, that's not the current plan.
If they get a recession, they get under pressure, and then they have to do something about it.
I do wish these central banks would listen to me, listen to Milton Friedman, listen to other people of my line of thought on this matter. We want stable growth of quantity of money in order to have stable economies, and low growth of quantity of money in order to defeat inflation. Now, can I just say, obviously, because I'm talking to you and you're from Germany, that the Bundesbank understood this message very well. The Bundesbank provided a model to Europe in the sort of 50 years of its existence up to the late 1990s when it then had the single European currency and so on. But the Bundesbank understood this very well. We had debates and discussions about this in America, Britain, and other countries too. I'm afraid those debates and discussions and the lessons they contained have been forgotten.
You say they've been forgotten, and I challenged you already on this when we spoke last year in asking, there was a correlation between the growth rate of money and inflation, but obviously, some would argue that since the 80s, since the 90s, basically these last 30, 40 years, the formerly close correlation between monetary growth and inflation has broken apart. And they said basically monetarism is dead and we have different explanations for inflation. And when you hear this criticism and you say, I've got this example of last year, then people might say, it's supply chain issues and it's been corona and it's been as a war and there's been raw material scarcity, whatever. So there are many other reasons for inflation, and therefore your request of having a stable monetary growth just is not necessary because the quantity of money doesn't matter for inflation.
Okay, I think there's two topics there. One is, and I always insist on this in my work, it's vital to have the right money aggregate, the right concept of money in these discussions. Now, I'm very emphatic about this, I always use a broadly defined measure of money that includes all bank deposits. This upsets some people because including people who otherwise might be regarded as monetarists. Anyway, I'm just going to say that's crucial to illustrate this. We keep on getting these claims that QE in 2008, 2009 led to an explosion in the quantity of money and there was no inflation. No, it didn't. What was going on in 2008, 9, 10, and for the next few years was that banks were shrinking their loan books. That was going to destroy money balances. All that QE did at that time was to offset this very destructive deflationary force. And overall, the growth of the quantity of money in the sense of bank deposits was very low in the 2010s. It was very low from 2009 until 2019. I always look at broad money.
Broad money is the broadest measure, encompassing narrow money such as cash and checkable deposits, along with less liquid assets such as certificates of deposit, foreign currencies, money market accounts, marketable securities, treasury bills, and anything else that can be easily converted into cash, but not including company shares.
I don't look at narrow money. I don't look at the base. At least I don't look at them in the sense of making macro forecasts using them. That's very important. I have squabbles with people on my own side, if you wish, about this. The second point in your question was the monetary explanation against the non-monetary explanation, that people say that inflation currently arises because of the Ukraine, particularly at the moment, but even before that, the energy price increases, the shortages of semiconductors, a whole host of various supply-side shocks. I want to make three points. One, in the last 2 years, we have seen very dramatic asset price inflation is coming to an end now. Very dramatic inflation, for example, in the price of houses. We've seen this in the Eurozone, the USA, the UK, and so on. I would say this is caused by too much money growth, excess money causing chasing too few assets. Explain the movement in German or British house prices by the price of wheat in Ukraine or the price of oil or something. The houses were built decades ago, for the most part, rubbish. This cycle is like many other cycles. It's too much money created, it hit asset prices, caused a boost in demand, shortages of supply. These supply shortages are a symptom of the problem, not a cause. And this then led to rising prices of goods and services. Make a further point. Rates of money growth differ between different countries at present. Japan had much slower money growth than the United States. And in China and India, although they had rather high money growth, there was no difference compared with the previous 5-10 years, hardly any difference. Japan has less inflation than the United States. Inflation in China and India hasn't changed that much. The explanation of these differences is the behavior of the quantity of money. Can I again just say here, Germany provided a brilliant lesson of this in the 1970s. The system of fixed exchange rates is breaking down. The Bundesbank very bravely said, Deutschmark will leave the dollar, will leave the dollar behind, in fact. The Deutschmark rose in value. The Bundesbank kept the quantity of Deutschmarks limited. Exchange rate rose. Inflation was much lower than in Britain and the United States. And can I just say finally that on this front, that just had some evidence from Governor of our Bank of England, a chap called Andrew Bailey, to our House of Commons, where he says, I can't control the price of wheat, the price of oil and the rest of it. Oh, the wickedness of it. He can control or take steps that influence the quantity of money. And it's his job as governor of the Bank of England to make sure these things are done. He's learned nothing in his 30, 40 years working at the Bank of England.
We have seen in the period since 1980 until now, debt levels overall in the Western world have risen dramatically relatively to GDP. The banking sector, the bank's balance sheets have exploded over these 40 years. At the same time, we have seen 40 years of shrinking inflation. So how does this fit into the story?
It's very important to understand that debt and debt issued by banks, if you wish, are not the same thing. There has been growth of debt relative to incomes, not just in the last 40 years, but actually the last 60 or 70 years, really since the Second World War. Can I just say in that period, public debt has fallen relative to GDP in nations like the USA and the UK. In Germany, the debt was wiped out in the late 1940s by inflation. But the explosion of private debt continued really from the late 1940s, early 1950s through to 2008, 2010. It's been somewhat slower since. First point, you must look at bank deposits. Again, I come back to bank deposits, quantity of money. In the 2010s in particular, the growth of banking systems was being held back by these capital rules. And so the growth of money was lower than in the previous decades. The growth of normal GDP was lower. Inflation was lower too. I just make a second point, which is a kind of, in a sense, it's rhetorical, polemical, much whatever you wish. Most debt is incurred to acquire an asset. Obviously, the typical case is a young family borrowing in order to buy a house, which they're then going to live in, and the house is collateral for the loan. Okay. But most corporate debt, again, isn't just for general expenditure by the company. It's actually, say, to acquire another company, to acquire, say, some land, to invest in some capital equipment. And so what you see in Western economies over the last 70 years or so is that the growth of the capital stock has been higher than the growth of debt. So what you find if you compare the data available to the United States, and I've done the work, if you say compare 1946 with 2021, you'll see that the ratio of debt to GDP has risen enormously, and yet net wealth, that's gross wealth minus the debt, is also higher relative to GDP. And this reflects greater, if you wish, financial activity relative to the economy as a whole. And I would say, I'm going to use this word that's, again, a polemical word, greater financial sophistication. Essentially, the growth of the capital stock improves productivity. Obviously, machines become more efficient. People learn how to use the machines and so on. So the incurring of debt is actually part of the process of economic growth and is not something that necessarily is wicked or wrong. Can I just make a fun final point here? You sometimes get in this particular space, you get this hysterical statements like the world is drowning in debt. Not possible, I'm afraid. Planet Earth cannot be in debt to Mars or Venus. Sorry. All debt is owed between individuals, companies, households, and so on, and every debt is matched by an asset.
That's obviously clear, and it's also clear that the asset values have grown faster than the debt levels, which also has to do with the leverage effect and just to do with the lower interest rates. Coming back, because you point out the strong correlation between the growth of the balance sheets of banks, now to be careful in how I phrase it, and the nominal growth rate of the economy. At the same time, you've now said that a big part of the credit is given out for the acquisition of assets. And I think this might be one reason why you have seen, at least in the 40 years, a lower correlation between the change in the size of balance sheets and the consumer price inflation.
Yes, I'm sorry to seem repetitive, but we make most of our payments by instructions to our banks to make payments from our bank deposits. Our bank deposits are most of our money balances. So in this subject, it's crucial to look at the behavior of money broadly defined to include all those deposits. And in the 2010s, the growth of those deposits was much lower than in previous decades. Inflation was lower and so on. And you can see in all economies a correlation between the growth of money and the growth of nominal GDP over periods of decades. And of course, the inflation rate is simply the difference between more or less between the growth of nominal GDP and the growth of real output.
Leads back to your proposal. Your proposal is in the future to have a stable growth of money. But how would you achieve it? Because basically what you tell me also, it's a result of decentralized decisions by banks and by individuals and companies. Mm-hmm. So how do you achieve this? Because the central bank can only indirectly influence it.
Okay, now this is where you get into debates between monetary economists, including, may I say, a debate between myself and other monetarists. The banking system's assets consist of loans to the private sector and claims on the state government securities, possibly cash reserves, which are claims on the central bank. Now, in order to keep the rate of money growth down to 2, 3, 4, 5%, in my view, the central banks should set interest rates appropriately so the growth of bank credit is consistent, credit to private sector, consistent with that sort of number. Suppose there's a problem. Suppose that the banking system wants to grow by 10% a year, which obviously will cause money growth to run at also a figure like 10% a year. This is the kind of problem we had for much of the period from the 1960s until 2008, 2010. Then first thing I would do is the banking system can shed its claims on the state. In the British case, the banking system in 1950, the great bulk of its assets were government securities that reflected the Second World War. By the middle of the 1980s, the British banking system essentially had no claims on the state because the growth of lending to the private sector had been so rapid. At any rate, monetary policy to me is a mixture of operations to affect the growth rate of credit to private sector, and also, which particularly is the setting of the appropriate level of interest rates, and also to influence the level of banking system claims on the government, which can be done through operations like quantitative easing, quantitative tightening, and so on. And this is the job for the central banks. Now, just so you understand where I'm coming from here, and these are areas of debate, they're very technical. I'm not sure how many of your listeners will understand what I'm talking about. There is an opposite point of view put put forward by Milton Friedman, among others, that there is a mechanical link between the monetary base, that's the size of the central bank balance sheet, essentially, and the quantity of money. I reject that point of view. That's led to bitter debates in my career.
Because you say the relationship is not stable.
The rate of growth of bank deposits should be kept stable by a mixture of operations and decisions taken by the central bank, act working with the government, yes. And that can be done. I don't regard that process as exact, precise, mechanical, and so on, but it can be done over periods of, you miss the target 1 year, over periods of 3, 4, 5 years, it can be done. And the Bundesbank showed that.
But basically, one of the instruments could be regulations, that you basically say if the credit growth is too high, you increase the minimum equity requirement for financing the purchasing of a house.
You can do that. I don't like doing that because I think it's important for the banks to be free. So I don't, this may sound a bit odd, I quite concede that in understanding the low inflation of the 2010s, the extra capital requirements on banks, very important, because that's what held back the growth of bank assets and meant that they weren't expanding at this kind of 10% a year kind of rate they wanted to do as they had done for much of the previous 60 years. But I want banks to be free. I don't want them to be bullied by regulators and governments. And they themselves don't want the kind of capital requirements that they now have had under the Basel III rules. In America, of course, there's much resistance to small banks, and Congress basically hasn't applied Basel III to the small banks. And across Europe, all European governments at the moment are letting the European Commission and the BIS know that they would like to have easier capital rules for their banks. That is a feature of the Eurozone at present.
Which means basically they want them to create more money, which basically means also they want them to enable higher inflation rates going forward.
Well, Germany at the moment, there's a problem because the Germans save a lot through their banks. They want a positive return. I would say the reason that interest rates have been so low is precisely because of these restrictions on the banks. What I would like is the banks to be freer so they can lend more to the private sector or try to do so, and then interest rates go up to stop them. We get back the kind of world we had in the 1980s, 1990s, and the first decade of the 21st century, when it is possible, as I've said, the Bundesbank showed it. It is possible to combine anti-inflationary monetary policy with a relatively free banking system and interest rates that are positive in real terms, please, which is what German savers want, and rightly so.
The opposite model would be to say, we take the ability of banks away to create money, and we basically go to the sovereign money. And even Martin Wolf from the FT has once written an article many years back that he was thinking in this direction. So wouldn't this be an opportunity? The banks could still hand out credit, but they would not create own money, but they would just only have money which has been created before by the central bank they could use.
Okay, this is a line of thought that it goes back a long way. May I say, in Britain, it goes back, in fact, the early 19th century, when we had a model for the Bank of England, something called the 1844 Bank Charter Act, where they thought that money was only the notes issued by the Bank of England, and they had an issue department that couldn't make loans, and all of its notes had to be backed by gold. And then it was supposed to be, there's a banking department like any other private sector bank. They discovered they couldn't work like that, and in the end, the whole balance sheet of the Bank of England was related to the quantity of gold that they held. It's a complicated story. I might go through that now. Essentially, I am in favor of a free financial system, and I have no worries on a religious grounds against the payment of interest or, if you wish, gambling in the financial sector. And things like insurance and banking are, to a degree, gambling because they're taking on risks. Both the banks and insurance companies taking on risks. Now, if you take these views, then you don't want to impose restrictions on anyone against the taking of risks. You don't want to impose restrictions on the banks from having loans that are claimed on the private sector. The narrow banking proposal, this sovereign money idea, is all about how the bank's assets must be perfectly safe. They must be either cash or government securities. Sorry, no, I want a banking system that is free. And I said earlier in this interview that you have the way that many banks began, say, in 18th century Germany, in places like Frankfurt and Hamburg, they were merchants. They came in as very creditworthy merchants, and their bills, bits of paper they issued, could be used as money, and then they became note issuers, they became banks. Now, can I just finish the very big subject? So essentially, I want banks to be free to assets other than cash and government securities. Can I just finish with, again, a somewhat, maybe a difficult note? Yeah, there are societies that prohibit the payment of interest, that prohibit gambling. Of course, I'm talking about Islamic societies. Why did Islam fall behind the West? That's one aspect of it, I suggest.
I'm sure it's one aspect, but though I thought it was the last question, but I have to ask another question, because now, listening to you, I understand people should be taking risks. On the other hand, the financial sector and the banks, they have taken risk, but when something went wrong, like in the financial crisis, they had to be rescued by governments in order to avoid a much bigger crisis. So taking on risk is fine, but how do we ensure that the people who take the risk also have to, you know, take the risk in the sense of when something goes wrong, they have to pay for it themselves?
You know, we live in mass democracies where sometimes public opinion acts like a lynch mob. It needs culprits. It needs somebody to blame. And this is what happened in 2008 and 2009. Let's be clear. The American government interfered in banks' operations, required them to issue new capital to itself, the American government, and has made a profit of tens of billions of dollars, probably hundreds of billions of dollars now, on those interferences in a private banking system. It is an understood feature of the capitalist economy, which explained by Walter Badgett in his 1873 book, Lombard Street, that the job of the central bank is to help commercial banks when they have a problem managing their cash on the assumption that they're solvent. Because the American banking system made a profit of hundreds of billions of dollars on the capital that it had to the loans that were extended to it by the American state, because the American government and the Federal Reserve made vast profit on this, plainly the banks were solvent in the middle of 2008. They had not taken on too much risk. And indeed, the estimates made by the IMF and I suppose other international bodies about the losses that would be reported by the American banking system in the 5 years from the middle of 2008 were rubbish. It was on the basis of those estimates of losses that the capital rules in Basel III were organized. The banks themselves didn't want these rules. And can I just, before I finish all this, Daniel, that imposition of higher capital rules was the real deflationary shock. That was the real shock that caused the Great Recession. Until the middle of 2008, certainly in Europe, there really was no sign of a recession. It was then this demand that the banks have much more capital and less risk relative to capital that caused the banks to start shrinking their loan books and then destroying money, and then that led to the Great Recession and required it to be offset by the cuts in interest rates to zero and QE. I know this is a controversial thesis. It's a bit like the thesis that Friedman and Schwartz made of the Great Depression in the United States. They said that the Great Depression wasn't caused by capitalism, it was caused by the Federal Reserve. And I agree with that entirely. It was caused by a stupid blunder on the part of bank regulators in autumn 2008.
And Ben Bernanke actually agreed. He said, we won't do the mistake again. That's what he said, and that's why
he told Friedman, it's said to be on Friedman's 90th birthday, but it couldn't work out that it was Friedman's 90th birthday. Never mind. He told Friedman, we won't make this mistake again. I'm sorry, Mr. Bernanke, you did make the mistake again.
Because he misunderstood. But what they kind of money he has to look for?
First of all, they didn't have this theory, which is my theory, if you wish, that the quantity of money, monetarism, is always about broad money. And they just did not see the connection between asking banks to have much more capital and then the contraction of the quantity of money that they were going to cause. They just didn't see it.
And now this leads me to my final, probably my summary of our conversation. If you look at the current development, so we had a spike in inflation due to the fact that broad money grew much, much too fast, which was supported by the central banks. Against the background of a structural policy of low growth rates of broad money due to the regulations post the Great Financial Crisis and due to the central banks looking at the wrong measures. And now we have the contrary policy, the central banks going on the brakes, amplifying a downturn, leading in the US to a recession, probably in Europe as well. And then we will continue with the path we had after the financial crisis, therefore a world with low inflation rates, low growth rates, and therefore many problems. I think this would be now my takeaway from the conversation.
Yes, that's right. I mean, let's hope that central banks understand that they must stabilize the growth of money at a low rate, similar to that, the trend growth rate of the output of goods and services. I think, though, that in trying to understand why the trend growth rate of the output of goods and services, you know, is so low, we shouldn't look to what the central banks are doing. This is a much wider story. And obviously, it's tied up with a number of things. Demographics, how is the working population growing or falling? And I'm afraid in the case of Europe today, working population, working age is actually falling. It's tied up with things like skill acquisition. It's tied up with education. It's tied up with capital investment. It's tied up with the rate of technical progress. These are all things that are, to use the economist jargon, these are kind of supply side real things. That they are not something that can be altered by messing around with the monetary dials and trying to alter the central bank mandates or whatever. Central banks cannot alter the trend growth rate of the economy, except to a very limited extent. I think that having price stability is positive for economic efficiency, but that the trend growth rate of the economy is given by supply side forces fundamentally.
So we are going to become like Japan and Europe?
That may well be the case, something like that. Can I just say that the Japanese in the last 20 years, they may have had little growth, 20, 30 years, having had amazing growth before that. It seems to me they've been a very stable society, peaceful society. What's wrong with that?
I think it would be a good outlook if Europe manages to get in such a stage. Tim, thank you very much for your time. And thank you very much for bearing with me, for asking stupid questions and getting confusing the terminology from time to time. But I will promise I keep learning.
I've been polite in answering questions. I'm very grateful to you for your questions and thoughts. Thank you.
Thanks so much. So stay tuned for further editions of my English version of the podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it and looking forward to welcome you soon again at Beyond the Obvious 2.0.
BTO, Beyond the Obvious 2.0.